I went to a meeting recently, and I'm a front row sitter, because so I can sit in here, and I sat in the front row, and everybody sat in the back, second row, and I thought, okay, the second row is going to fill up. Pretty soon, people are going to have to start sitting in the front row. And every time someone came in, they would take a chair from the front row and move it back to the second row. And before long, there was only one chair left in the front row, and it was the one I was sitting in.
Oh, my gosh.
So I picked up my chair and moved it back. Everyone ended up in the front row.
Who's going to sit there?
So did the speaker move forward then, too?
Huh?
Did the speaker move forward, too?
No, I think they just stayed put, but it was just funny, because then everybody was just back further. I guess they needed
my brother was a motivational speaker at the LCA Church. And he always said, if I was going to build a church, the first six rows would be absolutely elegant.
Yeah.
Plush.
Would never be used.
You think the Lutherans would go up there and sit?
Depends on their age.
Yeah, you have to first years in our church. Yes.
Tell me the name.
We have the first three rows.
I was going to say NASA.
Yes.
That night in the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Are you informed that we were playing NASA? We thought we were just playing it.
I knew, and I could think, but I was thinking Nikki was one across from me. I get the names all mixed up. Okay, we'll get started now, I think. Does everybody's watch say about quarter of? Okay, so now you can start the tape. This session is called The Buttercup Has My Smile. And my name is Lynn Massey, and this is about my journey through cancer, and I know other people's some stories from other people. And I know that I am not alone in the village in having cancer. I know there are at least two other people here, and probably possibly even more, even in this room. Last week I did this, and there were actually a couple of people in the room. So I'll ask that question right off. Does anybody here currently have cancer, or recently, or wants to talk about it? Nikki?
14 years ago.
Okay. Anyone else? I've had cancer for 3 years. It started as breast cancer. It spread into my chest, and which is kind of an unusual place for breast cancer to spread, but it did. And throughout this journey, and I call this a journey because journeys to me don't have necessarily known destinations or known outcomes. And so to me, this has been a journey for 3 years. And Nikki, share, you know, and you share, please feel free to share some of your stories or experiences. Basically, I'm doing this because I want it to be an open discussion. My daughter was studying biology in high school and told her teacher when they started studying cancer, said, oh, my mom's got cancer. And he said, would she come in and speak to the class? And my daughter said, sure. So she says, Mom, I told them you'd come and talk to the class. And I said, okay, about what? You know, and she said, well, just about cancer. So I went into the high school not knowing. These were, I can't remember if they were juniors, I guess. And I went into the high school and I thought, well, I don't know if I'm going to be here 5 minutes or exactly what. And it was fascinating because they had so many questions, and I think we talked for probably an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And they had many, many questions, and then I think what was refreshing was they asked questions that you know are pretty much on everyone's mind, mm-hmm. but most adults are afraid to ask. What's it like to think you're going to die? You know, what's it like to lose your hair? What's it like to be on chemotherapy? What's it like? And then they started telling stories of their relatives or grandparents who had had cancer, and they asked me questions they had not been able to get answers to at the time. And so this is a place where you can ask any and all questions. I think it's you know, it's a process, and I'm finding more and more people I talk to that a lot of people don't know how to deal with, don't know how to cope with, and don't know how to talk to people who are going through it. So please feel free as we go along to ask any questions and share your stories.
same line then.
Yeah.
It's hard for us that never experienced cancer to know from you how we can talk to people that have cancer.
Well, hopefully I can give you some insights on that and share not just my story, but other people's. So I've heard it from enough people to know that I wasn't unique. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a doctor. I'm simply somebody who's been coping with cancer and in the best way I know how. And I can tell you now that I think that cancer has been a gift. I feel it changed my life dramatically. I felt that God had been hitting me over the head many, many times with many, many messages, and I didn't listen, didn't pay attention. And finally, I decided, I've come to the conclusion, he finally said, okay, we're going to have to hit you with a 2x4 to get you to listen. And it changed my life dramatically. And I have really enjoyed my life more in the last 3 years than I think in my first 50. I'll start with just 2 paragraphs from my book. It's kind of the beginning of the story. I was sitting at my desk on a Friday morning, preparing for a last-minute meeting with the engineers. The phone rang. Irritated at the interruption, I grabbed it quickly, intending to hang up as fast as I could, so I could get to the meeting that was to begin in 5 minutes. Hello, Lynn. It's Dr. S. I just got the results of your test. Lynn, they don't look good. They don't show anything definite, but you need to see a specialist on Monday. Foolishly, I replied, but I really want this to wait until I get back from Bangkok. I'll only be gone a week, and I promise I'll see him as soon as I get back. And the silence was deafening. I can still hear it seeming to last forever. No, Lynn, this cannot wait. You must cancel your trip. And then it sank in, and I knew. My world crashed around me, and tears began flowing down my cheeks. The intercom was saying, Lynn Massey, the meeting has started. But it no longer mattered. What was so critical 5 minutes ago no longer made any difference. I slowly picked up my things, walked into the conference room, and said, I'm sorry. Something more important has come up, and I cannot be here for this meeting. I have things to do. Dumbfounded, the entire staff sat speechless, wondering what had come over me. I left, went home, and prepared a beautiful dinner for my family. No frozen dinners that night. Mom found time to cook. And at the time that I was diagnosed and that this happened, I was director of international marketing and sales for a large international company. I was traveling overseas. I was spending 2 and 3 weeks a month overseas in Europe, in the Pacific Rim. I was living in what is often defined as the fast lane. And I really did. I kept saying to my doctors, but you know, this is probably academic, this can just wait. And they kept insisting, no. And what was so dramatic and is how fast and how rapidly my life changed. I'm going to read you a couple of poems that I wrote throughout this journey and have been writing. And one of them, I won't read you this one, but one of them is called It Only Took a Day. And it was amazing to me how fast just a few words could change your life so dramatically. On that Monday, I went to the surgeon's office and sat there, and I really was expecting this whole process to be academic. I know so often you go to doctors and they'll say, well, we think this is nothing, but we're going to do some tests to find out. And many of my friends who had found breast lumps or lumps had heard that. So this is what I kept expecting. But I wasn't getting any reassurances. And when I went into the surgeon's office, he looked at my x-rays and he examined me, and it took about 5 minutes, and he said, you have cancer. And I said, what? And he said, you have cancer. And I said, how can you possibly diagnose me this fast? Don't you have to go through a series of tests and everything? And he said, I can tell you right now it is. What had happened to me, I was traveling, I was on a trip, I had been getting my little postcard telling me it was time for my mammogram. I got very busy. Next time I'm in town, I'll schedule it. And an entire year went by with me saying, oh golly, I keep forgetting. Next time I'm in town, I'll schedule my mammogram. And it ended up being 3 years since my last one. But again, I thought it was academic. I had just turned 50, and there's still controversy over how often women need mammograms. And what happened was I started reading a book about menopause, and it talked about breast exams. And so I thought, well, gee, you know, I better examine my own breast. And I didn't find any kind of a lump. The doctor didn't find a lump, which is what I expected. What I did find was that the entire top half of my breast was very hard. It was like a rock, and the nipple was puckered in. And it was the nipple puckering that scared me. And I called the doctor, and they said, come right away. And I said, I can't, I'm out of the country. And they said, get here as soon as you can. So I did, and I went in, and then that was on a Wednesday, and then Friday was when I wrote that paragraph, and Monday was when I went to the surgeon. So everything turned into a whirlwind. And he said, well, how long do you think I've had this? He said, I would say you've had it, based on the size of the tumor that I can feel, I would say you've had this for over 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I just said, what? I have had cancer for 2 years and you don't know it. I didn't know it. I don't know what your symptoms were, Nikki, but I didn't have a clue. I felt fine, I kept saying, but I feel fine. I mean, I did an instant mental review of the last 2 years in my head thinking, was there a clue, was there a clue? And there wasn't. And he said, your tumor is very large and I'm gonna be surprised if it's confined to the breast, it may have spread. We've got to see exactly what we're dealing with. And he said, we'll do the biopsy on Thursday, this is Monday. And he said, between now and then you have to have brain scan, bone scan, liver scan, blood tests, chest x-rays. They're looking to see where else it had gone. The normal metastasis sites are lymph, for breast cancer, are lymph nodes, brain, lungs, liver, a bone. Bone is a common place for it to go. So they began the search, and I went through a battery of tests in the next 3 days. And as I said, I was preparing for a meeting in Bangkok. I was to go that Thursday and have this meeting. I had 15 distributors coming in from 15 different countries. And I thought, what do I do now? So immediately I called somebody that I worked with and I just said, I can't go. You gotta go for me. And he said, what? And I said, pack your bags, you're going. And I said, I'll FedEx you a bunch of slides and just do the best you can. And that was it. And I left the office. And immediately went home, and I kept thinking, what am I going to do now? How do I tell my children? I called my husband and said, they told me it's cancer. He says there's no doubt. And I said, what am I going to do? And I cooked dinner, and I was crying, and I was thinking, what do I say to my kids? They were 11 and 14. And I called my minister, and she said, you have to tell your family today, because they're going to know something's wrong. I couldn't stop crying. Every time I looked at my kids, I started crying, thinking, oh, man, we're going to see them grow. And so I went home that night, and I sat the kids down, and I told them. And said that, I think at that point, I said we didn't know for sure that they were doing a series of tests. And we would know more on Thursday. And I went through the tests, and then they did the biopsy, and when they came back, they said it goes all the way to the margins, which means that of the sample that they took out, and they took a fairly extensive part of my breast out for the biopsy, because they like to go beyond the tumor to try to get clean tissue. But they couldn't find any, and they went as far as they could, and it went all the way to the margins. They didn't get any healthy tissue in the biopsy. So he said, well, this is not a particularly very good sign. And it came back, and some of the indicators are, they have what they call the S phase, and this is how many cells are reproducing at any one time. Generally, a breaking point is around 7%, and so they say if you're less than 7% of the cells are reproducing simultaneously, it's a fairly good prognosis. Any more than that, it's a shifts you over into a poor prognosis, and mine was 12%, so it was quite high. It was breast cancer can be estrogen positive or not estrogen positive. Mine was not estrogen positive, which makes it harder, a little harder to treat.
What do you mean by that?
Estrogen positive means that it actually feeds off of estrogen. So the cancer cell has receptors on it, and that's how it grows, and that's how it gets its food. It goes out and looks for estrogen in the body, or it takes the estrogen and feeds off of it. And now there are drugs on the market that are estrogen blockers, and this is a fairly common way to treat estrogen positive cancer. And the estrogen blocker does is it attaches itself to the cancer cell where the estrogen receptor is, and it prevents the cancer cell from getting any estrogen, and then it dies, it starves itself. And so it's a little more treatable than the non-estrogen positive. It's a little bit harder to treat. So they told me I had to have a mastectomy, and they actually told me that the diagnosis was for both breasts, not just one breast, because this type of cancer is fairly diffuse, and they said it always occurs in both breasts. I did refuse to have a mastectomy on the right breast. I had it on the left. I told them they could do this. We had many, many discussions with the surgeon and the doctors over this, and I kept saying it doesn't make sense to me if you don't find it currently in the right breast. So they did. We agreed to do a biopsy. I'm checked every 3 months anyway, and they said that they're keeping a very close eye out for it. They have told me pretty much with certainty that it will occur there, but I don't know when. So I scheduled a mastectomy and went into the hospital and had the surgery. When I went home that first night after hearing that I had cancer, I was born and raised an Episcopalian. I had always gone to Sunday school. I had always gone to church. I consider myself a very good Christian. And I got in bed that night, and I really had trouble saying any prayers at all. And what I did was I found myself shaking my fist and screaming at God. And I was making demands. I was saying, okay, it's payback time. I've done all these things. I've gone to Sunday school. I've gone to church. I've been in the youth group. I've done this. I've done that. You owe me. And that was the form of my prayers to God. And I said, I have no intention of leaving this planet. I've got young children, and you had better do whatever you have to do to make certain I survive. And that's where I was spiritually at that time. When I talked to my children, the only thing I could say to them, and this was a very new approach to my kids, because I always thought being the mother, I had to have all the answers. And I didn't have any answers. I had none. And I kept saying, what am I going to say to them? And finally I thought, the only thing I can say is, I don't have any answers. I need you to take my hand, and I need you to go on this journey, and my husband, and I need you to go with me. I don't know how far we're going to go, and we may have different destinations, but when it comes time for the road to split, we'll be able to say the journey was a good one, and we'll be ready for it. And so they did. They rallied. But at first it was difficult. To them, cancer meant death, because exactly 1 year, almost to the day before I was diagnosed, their grandmother, my husband's mother, died of breast cancer. So as soon as they heard breast cancer, they equated it with her death. And it was very difficult. My husband was an only child, and he had a great deal of trouble coping with the death of his mother, and then for me to come up and have breast cancer. So in the movies, people may rally together and hug each other and say, oh, this is wonderful, we'll go through this together. But that didn't happen to us. We fought, we yelled, we screamed. We were at each other's throats, and it took quite a while before anyone was able to give any comfort to anyone else. My husband's an engineer, and he loves numbers and statistics, and every time I tried to talk about my scare or concern, all I got back was a pile of numbers, and I would get furious. I don't care about statistics. So So it was hard. It was difficult. And it wasn't until we went into family counseling with a hospice counselor that we each discovered we each had our own way of coping with the disease and with the scare of the disease. And that helped us tremendously because every person deals with it differently. My husband immediately went into denial and he stayed there. And it helped me to understand, the counselor helped me understand that was what he had to do to protect himself emotionally. And my son got very scared. He wouldn't come see me in the hospital. Whenever I had my treatments, he would disappear. He'd spend the night at friends. He didn't want to be around. He's still scared, but he's much better. So we each dealt with it in our own way. But and what's happened on this journey is it's proven to be that we've had a life full of laughter, full of fun, full of very spontaneous moments. And we've had a lot of fear, a lot of scare, and a lot of tears. It's been run the whole gamut. But it's been very honest. And I think really what became important was in our family, cancer took a back seat. Because what mattered then was how we lived our life each and every day. And one day I said, it was on a Thursday, and I said, I'm not doing anything this weekend, let's go to Disneyland. Now we live in Oregon, Disneyland's in California. Everybody said, what? And I said, let's go to Disneyland. And my husband said, you're crazy, we'll go next summer. And I said, I may not be here next summer. Let's go now. And we did. We packed up, I called the airlines, I had all these frequent flyer points. I said, they're gonna go to waste, I'm gonna die and they're gonna go to waste. So I said, let's just use these miles for something. Called the airlines, cashed in miles, got tickets, and on Saturday morning we left to go to Disneyland and spent Sunday, Monday in Disneyland, and I think it's the best time we've ever had. And it was just a lot of fun. Anyway, back to the surgery and the mastectomy. I had a great deal of trouble dealing with the loss of a part of my body. And I don't know what you went through with this, but for me, it was a part of me. And if I'd said this to people, they'd say, well, it's only skin, it doesn't matter. Now, I know everyone was saying that to make me feel better, to say, well, it's only skin. But you see, I didn't feel that way. And I kept saying, yeah, but where's my soul? Does anybody know where my soul is? And do you know where my soul is? And how do you know my soul is not in my breast? And how do you know I'm not losing a part of it? And how do you know I'm not losing an important part of myself? And so this bothered me a lot. And the morning of the surgery, when I went to the hospital, I still couldn't come to grips with it. And they tried to give me tranquilizers, and I refused. I said, no. And so I suddenly, the thoughts going through my head dealt with how much of me was in my breast. And I'd like to just read you one of the poems that I wrote. I scrounged around and asked the nurse for a piece of paper. I got an envelope, and I was scribbling on the back of the envelope because I knew the surgery was going to be coming very soon. And this is what I wrote. It says, does the breast have a soul? Does the breast have a soul? People tell me it's only skin, that it's not necessary. But that's not what I feel. I feel it's part of me, and I am part of it. How much of me is in there? Am I in every cell of my body? Where is my soul? Where are my feelings? Are they only in my heart? That's what everyone says. They're in the heart. But is it true? Who says so? How do you know that my soul is not in my breast? How do you know that who I am is not there? Before it goes and before they take it away, I want to move the part of who I am that's in there to somewhere else. I want to empty that part of my soul and myself to another part of my body. I want to thank my breast, thank it for what it has given me. It helped me know I was going from girlhood to womanhood. It nursed my babies. It fed them well. It gave me shape. It gave me the form of a woman. It pleased my husband, and it pleased me. Is it still necessary? Am I still necessary? Can I be whole without it? Can I let go of it? Am I ready? Am I ready to make my peace with it Or am I still angry at it for betraying me and for getting this disease? Is it ready to go? Is that why this happened? It knows it's time to move on. Can I accept its desire to leave, like a child leaving a parent? I tell my parents they must let me go. Am I ready to let go of my breast in the same way? Can I say it's time, and can I let it go peacefully? They're coming now, they're coming to take it away. It's time for it to leave. I've mourned my breast. I've said thank you. I've moved the part of my soul that's in my breast to other places in my body. I am ready. They can take it now. It's now only skin. And I kid you not, the minute I finished writing that, the stretcher was in the door. And they said, Massey. And I said, I'm ready. You can go. So I had the mastectomy.
Did you cry during that time?
Did I what?
Did you cry?
No. No.
You had gotten over that part of it.
I was fine. They took me into the operating room. I was alert. They said, didn't you take a tranquilizer? I said, nope. I watched them get ready. And I said, okay. I was very ready for it. And then I had the surgery. And, I mean, it's major surgery, so it's fairly unpleasant. I think one of the things that I was coping with at that time, on the emotional side, was it was as if from the minute I was diagnosed, I had somehow proven to people around me I wasn't capable of taking care of myself. I'm a very independent person, and unsolicited advice was coming from everywhere. And I know people meant well, but I found myself getting quite angry at, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. I found lots of people saying, well, it's because you were traveling too much. Well, it's because you were eating the wrong things. Well, it's because you didn't get enough rest. And I know they were well-meaning, but I was overwhelmed with guilt. I felt that I had caused this disease. Somehow I had done something to create it. My doctors, I kept asking my doctors, and they said, we really don't know. We really don't. Yes, there's been studies showing, you know, trying to link high-fat diet to cancer, but that's not always a correlation. And so while people were trying to help me, it made me feel terribly guilty. And I felt that the day before I was diagnosed, no one felt the need to step in and try to run my life. And suddenly the day after, it's like everybody had permission to start telling me what to do and how to live my life, especially my family. Yes.
Was there any one person who did all the right things or said the right things, and what did they
probably say? Not, and I don't know that anybody could have, you know, because how do you know? But no, and I think a lot of it was just I need to withdraw when I'm overwhelmed. And people were coming out of the woodwork to help. And I loved it, and it was wonderful. It was overwhelming. And
but one
so,
thing you said, you didn't take tranquilizers or anything before you went into surgery.
Yeah.
Don't you feel it was because you realized it was to help you, that it was either that, or if you didn't have the surgery, you had no hopes?
I knew I had to have the surgery.
Yeah.
I knew I had to have the surgery.
I went through an experience like that, and they couldn't believe how calm I was.
Yeah, that's what the nurse couldn't believe. It. She kept saying, you know, why don't you want this? And I said,
you've got to have it. You can't fight it.
I said that I'd come to grips with it, and I wanted to survive. I said I would do anything. One of the poems I wrote was called The Crawl Through Hell. And in The Crawl Through Hell, it was, I will do anything to survive, because I have said, and I still say, I want to look back and say, I have done everything I can. And I can look at my children and say, I have done everything I can and everything known to survive. If I don't survive, you know, that's it. And then I had the surgery, and then the news got worse because they then found a tumor down in my chest, which they were hoping not, and that meant the cancer had spread beyond my breast. And so that was not good. And they came out and told my family, they said, it is not good. The prognosis is not good, because once it's moved beyond the breast, then you don't know where it is in the body. And it hard. They took out the lymph nodes because that's usually the first place they look. And having a tumor down in my chest is an odd place for it to go, but it did.
So it wasn't any lymph nodes?
No, the lymph nodes were clean. So it went a different direction, but it did penetrate through the breast wall. And then they said the prognosis isn't good. And they could not find any healthy tissue. So they kept going as far as they could, and they just came and told me, they said it's everywhere we've looked, we have found malignant cells, so we, you know, it's pretty extensive. But then the doctor said to my mother, he said, however, I'm going to tell you this. He said, she's one of the strongest patients I've had, and if anybody's going to beat this, she will. And I said, you bet. And I had read a book by a woman named Judy Allen called The Five Stages of Getting Well. She had liver cancer. She had less than a 1% chance of survival. That was 7 years ago, and she's still alive today. And she said to the doctors, I don't want to hear numbers. I just want to know, do I have a chance of surviving? Has anyone ever survived this? And they said, yes. And she said, okay, that's all I need to know. And I read my chart one day, which was probably a mistake. They handed it to me as I was going down to one of my treatments, and so of course I read it. And that disturbed me because in there it said I had a very poor prognosis. But then I thought I knew that already. And I didn't care. I didn't care. I had about a 25, I still have, about a 25% chance of survival. But who knows how long it is? Nobody can predict. And you don't know. You don't know. There's a woman in the village who has been in remission for 10 years and then had 3 recurrences in 1 year. You don't know when or how it may come back. But I do know I'm being watched a lot more closely than I was watching myself before. So, and I'm still on chemotherapy. After the surgery, I had to go into a very intensive chemotherapy program, and they told me it would be very intense because the cancer was aggressive, it was widespread, and they really wanted to try to hit it as hard as they could. So they prepared me for it. I talked to a lot of people. I read a lot of books about the drugs I'd be taking, and I knew it was going to be difficult.
Was this the stem cell treatment or something different?
No, this was they usually use a combination of drugs. I was on drugs called Adriamycin, 5-FU, and Cytoxin. They use a combination of drugs. Is that the same ones you were on? Mm-hmm. And because they found that drugs in combination seemed to work better. So I started on the chemotherapy, and it scared me. I didn't know what it was going to be like, and I'd heard all these horror stories. And they told me before I started, they said, go get a wig now, you're going to lose your hair. And you'll lose your hair within 10 to 14 days of your first treatment. And so I thought, and then I asked her, I said, well, what's it going to be like? Am I going to shed like a dog? Is my hair going to all fall out at once? Or, you know, is it going to lose half of it on one side and have hair on the other side? And she said, no, it'll be sudden, it'll be rapid, and it'll probably come out all at once. So after my first treatment, at that point, I did not have a tube in my chest, which is how they normally do it. They were doing it intravenously, which was very difficult, and after 3 treatments, they had to go in and put what they call a Gershon catheter in my chest because I couldn't take any more. My veins were totally shot. And so I had a tube that went in right through here, and it goes right into the vein and down to the vena cava where all the blood comes together. And it's less, it's easier on the body because there's so much blood flow. Going into the veins is extremely, I mean, the nurses wear all kinds of things handling these drugs. They've got gloves everywhere. And I'm saying, yeah, but you're putting it in there. So, because they're careful not to get any on the skin. So I finally did have a tube that you wear and you just tape it down to your chest and you have to flush it out and clean it on a regular basis. And you get used to it. That scared me too. I was terrified of cleaning it and flushing it. But you get very used to it. So anyway, I took my treatment and then I kept looking every day and I'd go like this. My hair was there. And on day 10, nothing happened, and I thought, well, maybe I won't lose my hair. But on day 11 or 12, my head started to itch, and it really itched. But I kept tugging, and my hair was tight. And then on day 13, my head started to hurt. It hurt like you've combed your hair the wrong way. And it just, my scalp hurt terribly. And to the point that I had to lie down with a pillow rolled up behind my neck. And then the day 14, I took a shower and it all came out in the shower. That was it. I just started to wash my hair and I did this and I just had hands all over my hair. And I kind of looked like a gorilla taking a shower and it was gone. That was it. It came out all at once. And no one was home and I was so disappointed because I was so excited. I wanted to show everyone. There was no one there with the dog. And so, and the interesting thing with the hair loss is you lose every hair on your body. I mean, it's not just up here, your eyebrows, your eyelashes, your arms, everywhere. It all comes out. And the reason you lose your hair is that the chemotherapy, cancer cells are rapidly reproducing cells. And the drugs are designed to go after rapidly reproducing cells. That's what they attack. They're getting more pinpointed, but the cells, and the reason you get sick is the cells in the digestive tract and the hair follicles are the most rapidly reproducing cells in the body. And that's why people get so sick from the chemo and why you lose your hair. I was very lucky because 2 months before I started my chemo, they came out with virtually a miracle drug called Zofran. And Zofran is an anti-nausea medication. And it made a huge difference. I still got terribly sick, but it wasn't as bad. And they learned that I would have my treatment. They'd give me my Zofran, give me the treatment, and then 30 hours later, I had to go back into the hospital to get additional treatments of Zofran so I could get through. And you learn a routine. It becomes part of your routine. And so I learned that I would go in for my chemo, and then I would be totally incapacitated, usually for about 5 days. And then I knew I could schedule something on day 6, and I'd be at about 50%. And then I knew the next week, there were 3 weeks in between treatments, and I knew the next week I'd be pretty much back to normal. And so I started coming up to Holden between my treatments. My doctors didn't want me to because your blood counts start getting very low, and your immune system is extremely weak. And but I said nothing bad will happen to me at Holden. I had to come here. It was my healing place. And it's really where I got in touch with my spirituality and where I learned to stop shaking my fist at God and screaming at him and saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. Why are you doing this to me? You're not supposed to give people more than they can take, and you've given me more than I can handle. But I learned that as I got through the process, I was coping with it. My family was coping with it. And there were some benefits starting to come out of it. So Holden for me was a healing place. The nurse who was here at the time, Gail Rossi, had been an oncology nurse, had worked with a lot of cancer patients. So I felt very safe with her. And I would check in with her every day. And I made sure I didn't handle dishes and I didn't take anybody's dishes off the table at that time. So.
How long did you stay here then?
I would stay a week because then I had to get back home. I would time it so I would be here the week just before a treatment, which was when I was the strongest.
What was your concern about handling dishes?
Yeah. Germs, because my immune system is so low. Your white count goes down very,
then
very
might
low.
Pick up someone else's germs.
Yeah, yeah. And if you get sick, it's very hard to. You just don't have the ability to fight infection. Once it starts attacking your white cells.
Have you terminated your profession now then, or are you?
I have made dramatic changes in my profession, yeah. Interesting thing, people appeared from nowhere. My minister told me, she said, when you start this process, she said, people that you expect to be with you throughout this journey are gonna disappear. And people who you don't have any clue about are gonna appear. Mm-hmm. And she was right. I didn't believe her. I did not believe her. I didn't believe that people who I thought, some of them who I thought were my best friends, would not be there with me. But they did disappear. It wasn't conscious. They just suddenly were too busy. They didn't have time. I'm really sorry I can't get over there. People I hardly knew stepped forward and brought meals and took me to treatments. And because I was so independent, this friend of mine said, I know you're not going to ask anybody for help. So she said, here's what I'm going to do. She said, anyone and everyone who gives you their and says, I want to help you, just write down their name and number and give it to me, because she said, I'll call them. And she knew everything that needed to be done. And she did. And it was great because it was a way that people who just wanted to do a little or wanted to do a lot could help. And she took the list and she'd call around and she'd say, Lynn's having a treatment next week. Can you take her to the hospital? And can you bring her home? Sometimes one person took me, somebody else brought me home. They need meals. Would you bring in meals? And she would line up all the meals. Or would you go over and do the laundry? Or, now my kids learned how to do a lot of this on their own. They had to become very independent. And that was really good for them because I had done it all for them. So I can't do this. Go do it yourself. You know, I can't help you. And they were having to help me. But people just came from nowhere. It was amazing how they appeared and how other people did disappear. And again, going through the counselor, I understood. And then they came back into my life when it was over. But it's kind of funny with cancer because in some ways, people react almost like you have the plague. I think some people are afraid it might be contagious. They're not sure. So they tend to back off. I didn't wear a wig. I went bald. And I didn't do it intentionally. I thought I'd wear a wig. I went and spent a lot of money on a wig. Did you wear a wig? Yeah. I spent a lot of money on a wig. And what happened to me was I said, I'm not going to wear any of that stuff in my own house. So one day I wanted to go to the grocery store and I wanted to get some soft drinks. And when you're bald, you don't know you're bald. And so I forgot I didn't have hair. And I got in the car and I went to the grocery store. And I walked in and I said, oh, golly gee, I forgot my wig. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be here very long. If I see anyone I know, I'll just I'll duck down another aisle and I'll hide from them or something. And as soon as I walked in, there was a teenager sorting soda cans and she looked up and I still had a few wisps of hair. So it was really kind of strange looking. I then cut them off when I decided I wasn't going to wear the wig and just let my head be totally bald. But I had these few little wisps of hair. She looked up and she did this and she says, wow, cool haircut. And the girl who I usually went to this check stand was looking and she went like this and she started laughing. And I said, I just became cool, good enough for me. And that was it. I didn't wear the wig again. And one time I was shopping in Gap with my daughter. And the interesting thing is your body starts to adjust. And your hair starts coming back. Even though you're still on the same drugs and still on the chemotherapy, it starts coming back. So I had all this fuzz all over me. And I was shopping and we were in Gap, and again, this girl with earrings out of every hole in her body came up and did like this, and she said, isn't no hair fun? And I said, yeah. And adults, you know, kids were so open. And I loved it. Whereas adults would talk to my ear or my shoulder. They didn't want to look at me, I. And so, but it was okay. And then finally somebody would say, have you been sick? And I said, yeah, yeah. And so it was kind of humorous. We've had some humorous times with it.
In talking to people, was that reaction of yours typical of others? Or were others more sensitive?
What do you mean?
Other people that have had the same kind of cancer, did they respond like you on this business of sensibility about hair?
No, most people wear wigs. I think now it's becoming a little more common not to, but 3 years ago, almost everyone wore wigs. And I think that, for me, one of the poems I wrote is called My Badge of Courage. And that is about my head, because I called my head a badge of courage. And I guess you could say it was a little bit of a political statement, because I feel many, many people go into denial about cancer, patients and friends. And I felt the wig turned me into a fake person. I felt that I wanted people to see the reality, and that cancer, there's a lot of incongruency with cancer because you look very healthy. I mean, people say to me today, and as I said, I'd had it for 2 years before I even knew. And so for me, I felt also that I had lost complete control of my life. It was controlled by outside forces. And I had a lot of difficulty with that. And so the one thing I felt I could absolutely positively stomp my foot and say no about was the wig. I had control over that. And so the one thing I had control over, I said, I'm not wearing. And so in a way, I felt that I wasn't going to allow myself to be turned into a fake person. And I also felt that I could assert my independence by saying no. And I know it goes back and forth. Some people said, I can't do that. I mean, I have to wear the wig. They wanted to wear the wig.
But wasn't it very uncomfortable for you to wear the wig?
Yes, it was horrible. The few times I put it on, I felt it was always crooked. It was sliding. You know, when you have hair and you try the wig on, it doesn't slide. Your hair holds it. But when you have nothing at all and your head's very slick, because it's not like shaving your head where you have bristle. It's just very smooth. I always felt the wig was too far forward, too far back, crooked this way. It itched and I'd kind of do like this. And I always felt self-conscious. So finally I said, the heck with it. And I was delighted not to wear it. I gained weight on the chemotherapy. One of the interesting things with chemotherapy is my oncologist told me, she said, the average patient gains about 20 pounds. I talked to a woman last week who was here. She put on about 30. And I said, really? I thought I'd be emaciated on chemotherapy. But I didn't. I didn't eat the whole week of my treatment. I did not eat anything at all because I was too sick to eat. And my mother tried to cram all kinds of things. She was terrified. And she was just so convinced I was going to starve to death. And so she would go buy Ensure and she'd put raw eggs in it. And I drank it once and I threw it up immediately and I said, that's it. And my doctor said, don't eat anything you like. And she was right, because you develop an aversion to it. Mm-hmm. And most things, anything I ate during my chemo, I can't eat today. So, and then I finally, I called my oncologist and said, look, I just can't eat. And she said, don't worry about it. For the next week, you don't have to. And then by the second, so I would go for a week and not eat anything. I would just drink water. But you do have to drink gallons of water. And I would drink the water. And you have to flush the adriamycin out of your system. Your urine turns red from it. And you know it's kind of out when your urine stops turning red. And so she said, don't worry about it. Well, they give you steroids. That's why you gain weight. They want to build muscle. So they're not too worried about what you eat that week. And so that's why people gain weight when they're on chemo. Then they tell you the wonderful news later that they don't want you to diet because it weakens your immune system. So I've been struggling with my weight gain. I gained a little over 20 pounds. One of the things you cope with cancer is the reality that you're going to die, or you may die. You don't know when. And you come to grips with, okay, everyone's going to die. Life is a terminal illness. And we're all going to die, and you don't know when. But it's scary because suddenly you think it's going to be soon. So you deal with that statement about none of us know when we're going to die, but you deal with it differently because suddenly you think it's a reality. And one of the things they tell you with cancer, they say you're not going to die right away. You know, it can be a long-term process. So I had to come to grips. I felt I had to come to grips with my own death. And that was difficult because a lot of people would not let me discuss it and would not let me talk about it. And I found it very important. And it wasn't just me. It's my friends who have had cancer. And they've gone through the same thing. And people say, oh, you're going to be just fine. You're going to be just fine. Uncle Joe had cancer and he was just fine. And I'd say, I'm not Uncle Joe. You know, I am me. And I wanted to say, yes, I know, but there are people who have a 95% chance of surviving, and there are people who have a 2% chance. And you can't compare the person with the 20% chance of survival with the person with the 95% chance. And so I found this very difficult. And it wasn't until I came to Holden that I came to grips with it, because there was a grief counselor here. One of my trips. And I talked to him, and I came in the winter and I came in the fall. I came several times in the year. And he was here, and I talked to him. And then I started telling him, and he said, yes. And I said, oh, I said, do you think I'm crazy? And he said, no. And he was the first person who understood, and he let me talk about it. And I said, I've already planned my funeral. I know exactly what it's going to be. He said, yeah, I can understand that. And so he allowed me to talk about it, and I started reading books on the dying process. And Bernie Siegel says something I think very significant. And that is that what happens with people, especially when they're in the latter stages, is there's a tendency to want to protect the patient. And it's understandable, but people would say, well, you can't do that. Well, why not? Well, you have cancer, you're on chemotherapy. And I said, I can do anything I darn well please. I may be leaving this planet soon, and I'm going to do anything I want to do before I leave it. And Bernie Siegel says, he was talking to a patient, a woman who was probably, he said, within 24 hours of her death. And they were telling jokes, and they were laughing. And when he left the room, somebody had been standing outside, overheard him, somebody who had come to see the woman. And she got furious. She said, how could you be in there telling jokes? Don't you know she's dying? And he said, there's no such thing as dying. You're alive or you're dead. And she is alive, and she has just as much right to enjoy life as you do. Why can't she enjoy it right up to the end? And I think this is wonderful. And of my friends, I know there was a woman who was terminal, and she wanted to go sailing. And she went out sailing, and she died on the sailboat. But by gum, she was having a great time. My friend Helen had lymphoma. She went into remission for 4 years, and it came back. And when it came back, she died within 4 months. It was very fast, and she knew it. And she knew, and she said, I'm ready. And we talked a lot about it. And she said it was such a relief for her to have someone she could talk to. And we talked about the dying process, and she said, I'm ready. And I talked to her, and I'd say, what you doing? Well, I'm cleaning out all my closets, getting rid of all this stuff. And okay. And I called her on a Monday, and I said, Helen, how are you doing? And she says, I'm ready. I know it won't be long. They've told me it's going to be soon. And I said, well, I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm not going to be able to call you tomorrow, but I'll call you on Wednesday. And I hope you're still here on Wednesday. And I said, but if you're not, I love you, and it's been wonderful, and you've been such a good friend. And she said, I love you too. And I said, you know, have a good journey if I don't get to talk to you again. And I did not. That was the last time I talked to her. She died Wednesday morning before I could call. But she had such a wonderful attitude, and she said, I'm ready. And I think that maybe that's a benefit of cancer, is you get to put closure on things. And I feel that if I die tomorrow, I'm ready. I really enjoyed my life. I live every single minute. We talk openly about it in my family. My sister gave me what she called a sunshine box while I was on my treatments. And in the sunshine box were a lot of goofy little presents. And I decided I would open 3 with each treatment that I had. And one of them was a little $1 plastic watch. Now, I had been traveling all over the world. I wore very expensive jewelry. I had diamonds. I had real pearls. I had, you know, very fancy, expensive watches. And what you learn is you look at all that stuff and you think, it's useless. And suddenly nothing mattered. I didn't even care how I dressed. Now, I wore silk suits and everything was color coordinated. If I wore a navy blue skirt, I wore a navy blue stocking. And one day I was going out the door and my daughter looked at me and she says, good grief, look at how you're dressed. And I said, what? And she said, you know, like you got orange pants and purple striped shirt and who knows stuff. And I said, am I naked? And she said, no. I said, then this is all that matters. And I suddenly had nothing mattered. So my watch, I still wear this watch because to me this is keeps my priorities straight. It reminds me of what is important in life. The watch tells time. That's all that matters. And I suddenly looked around my house and I thought, all this stuff is going to go to Goodwill. You know, so you get your priorities straight. But the death and dying, I encourage any of you who have friends with cancer, let them talk about it. You don't need to have answers. You just need to listen. And I think that's the number one message, is to say, nobody's expecting you to give them answers. It's just necessary to talk about the process, and it demystifies it. And not knowing, you know, what any outcome is going to be. I need to move on because I want you guys to have more time to talk. But my hospice counselor was saying that he had a family who was just terribly interfering with a terminal patient who just was not allowed to do anything that she wanted to do. And he finally turned to the family and said, look, it's her turn to die. She gets to do it any way she chooses. When it's your turn, you can do it your way. But right now, she gets to do it her way. And that's what I would say. This is my process. I can do it any way I want. You get to do it your way when it's your turn. So, one of the consequences of, for me, of the cancer, especially in the beginning, was I lost my ability to smile for quite a while into the process. And my sister had a brain tumor the year before I was diagnosed. She had a brain tumor. And what helped me come to grips with, and she said the same thing, that she couldn't smile. For about 6 months, she could not smile. And I said, me too. You know, I'm not sad. I just don't want to smile. And so one of the poems I wrote was The Buttercup Has My Smile, which is the title of the talk and the title of the book. And so I'm gonna read that to you, because it was really important for me to understand this process about my smile and what had happened to it. It was always there, my smile, I mean. Sometimes it didn't show, but it was there. And then it disappeared. It was gone, and I didn't know where. Cancer, they said, you have cancer. The smile left. Poof, it flew out the window. Where did it go? Smile, people would say. Why don't you smile? But it left me, and I didn't know where to find it. It was gone. I couldn't smile. Where did it go? Will it ever come back? Can I find it again? Will I find it again? Or is it gone forever? Forever to this dread disease. Forever to a new kind of life, a life of sadness, a life of pain, a life of fear. A life where smiles are out of place, a life without smiles. 1 month went by, 2 months went by. No smile. It seemed it was gone forever. Sad times, dreary times, crying times, tearful times, hurtful times. Smiles didn't fit. They didn't belong. They were nowhere to be found. Were they gone forever? Would I ever find them? They have to be someplace. I just don't know where. And then I found them. Suddenly I found my smile. It was in the buttercup. The buttercup was holding my smile. There it was in a field of purple flowers, one bright buttercup, shining and smiling. It spoke to me. It said, here it is. I have your smile. I'm keeping it for you. I know you will want it again. I know that one day you will need it again. I will keep it safe for you. I will keep it shining and polished and healthy for you. It was on Dr. B's wall. I suddenly stopped talking and recognized my smile. I want that picture. It has my smile in it. The picture of the purple flowers and the one shining buttercup. That buttercup has my smile. I wondered where it went. I thought it was gone. And now I have found it again. Here, he said, it's yours. It's now hanging on my wall. Every day it tells me that it is holding my smile for me. Every day it sees the tears in my eyes and says, it's okay, I understand. When you are ready, I will give it to you. Just let me know. Meanwhile, know that your smile is safe with me. It will not change. It will stay pretty and cheerful and happy. I will protect it for you. And when you are ready, when you're ready to smile again, I will let it go. I've come close a couple of times. I almost took it back, but not quite. The time was not right. The tears were still there. It wasn't the right time for the smile. I wanted to come back in full. I wanted to shine on me the way it shines on the buttercup. When I am ready to take care of it with the same gentleness and understanding of the buttercup, then and only then will I take it back. Look around you. Do you see any buttercups? Look at them and look at my smile. It's there and it's safe. One day soon it will return and the buttercup will release my smile. Please share it with me and rejoice with me. Enjoy looking at the buttercup. It's there and it's smiling at you for me. My smile has come back. And now just into moving on with life. As I said, it's been 3 years. I still have cancer. I'm still on chemotherapy. It's a milder program. It's nothing like the intense program that I was on. I'll be on it until next May. And every day I live in fear and I live in joy. Every time I have a checkup, I get very scared. I'm checked every 3 months. they're looking very hard because they're pretty sure that it's going to show up again. But I said it can't show up because I have to get my children grown, and then it can show up, but not until then. So the biggest problem I have now is probably regulating my body temperature. It seems to interfere with it. I'll tell you one funny story and then read you one more poem and we're done. I made the decision not to have reconstructive surgery. A lot of women have it, and it's very important to them. And reconstructive surgery is where they actually rebuilt the breast. They would not let me do it for the first year because the chemo was intense, and because they had found the cancer down in my chest, and because they needed to be able to check and see on x-rays. And I spent a lot of time debating about the reconstruction and the plastic surgeon, and one of the negatives is they can't see behind it. And this concerned my surgeon, so he was not, my doctors were not in favor of the reconstruction. And they told me I had to wait at least a year until I was through all the chemo. Well, by the end of the year, I didn't care. And my body looks very natural to me the way it is. You know, there's a clan of one-breasted women, and it's okay. I have a very small scar, and it just looks like this is the way God made my body. But we did have a funny story that I'll tell you with that. I wear a prosthesis. This is a rubber breast, and it feels very natural. And we went swimming one day. We went to the water slides. And I had bathing suits. I buy bras with I have pockets sewn in my bra so I can slip the prosthesis in, and the bathing suits have a pocket. But this particular bathing suit, it wasn't real secure, and normally it didn't matter. But we went on these water slides, and one of them was very steep, and you come down very fast, and you shoot out. And again, my mother would say, you can't go on those water slides. You can't do that. I said, I can do anything I please. I'm alive today. I'm going on the water slides. So I went on the water slides with my kids. That's why I said my kids said, Mom, you know, I was coloring and coloring books. I was just doing anything I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. So anyway, then we went on this water slide, and you come down with a great deal of force. And my daughter was standing on the other side of a railing watching, and along with a lot of people who weren't necessarily watching me, they were just watching everybody come down. And I came down, and I hit the water with such force, and I was disoriented, and I leaped up. Well, when I leaped up, this rubber breast is quite heavy, it went down. And it went down to about here. And it was like a slingshot. And then it went boing. And it went straight up and out. And this young kid's there, and you see. And this thing's floating, and he comes over and says, is this yours? Oh, yeah, that's mine. Thank you very much. My daughter, who's sitting back there against the wall, both doubled over. She couldn't even talk. I said, Dana, you're going to tell this story at my funeral. She was laughing so hard. And she says, Mom, I wish you could have seen these people next to me. And she said, it was so funny. And she said, this guy standing next to me said, what was that? And she said, just my mom. So so we've had some funny times with it. And so now, the last poem I'm going to read you is one I wrote called Beating Cancer. And that says,
you can be. Poems before?
No, never. Wow. Never written a thing in my life.
That's what's interesting.
And it just started because I would get so overwhelmed and I didn't know what to do, and I just started writing. And I think it's because finally, for the first time in my life, I slowed down. And because I was so emotional through the process, it put me very into my right brain. Normally I'm very left brain. And so this just started coming out, and I think I wrote 12 or 15 of them.
Did you do it intentionally?
No. I didn't even realize I was writing. I would sit down at my computer, tears would be pouring down my face, and it was the only way I could deal with the emotion. And I didn't, these poems have all, but not one of them has been edited. And not one time did I even look at I didn't sit and think. I just typed as fast as I could. I just typed, and then I said the end. And I never went back and edited them. I hardly reread them. I put them away. I started sharing them with friends who said, oh, you know, share more. Anyway, this one's called Beating Cancer. You can beat cancer. That's what Bernie Siegel says. You can beat it. My exceptional patients beat cancer, and yet they died. How can this be? It doesn't make sense to me. How can they beat cancer and die? Doesn't that mean that cancer beat them? And then suddenly I knew, like a flash, it occurred to me. Beating cancer is not about living and dying. Beating cancer is looking it in the eye and still being able to laugh. Beating cancer is enjoying life to the fullest, knowing that dying is part of life, knowing that one day we all will die. Beating cancer is opening up your mind to possibilities we never see. Beating cancer is not being afraid of your imperfect body. It's learning to use it to enjoy life, what God intended it for. Beating cancer is saying it can't make me ugly, because ugly is only possible to those who do not understand. Beating cancer is not about statistics on who will live and who will die. It's knowing that this is part of life. Beating cancer is making choices about how you will live and how you will die. It is being in charge. It is not being afraid. Beating cancer is going to Disneyland on the spur of the moment. Beating cancer is thinking as if you will live forever and acting as if you will die tomorrow. Beating cancer is playing golf with your son on a sunny afternoon. Beating cancer is taking flying lessons. I have reached these goals. I have beaten cancer. And crying when you feel like crying.
I hope it doesn't bother you when we cry, because I cannot.
I'm crying. Not at all. So, any questions you have?
How do you deal with someone, a very dear friend, sorry about crying, who has bone cancer, pelvic? He's an older friend. And I, not being part of the family, I feel he's kind of in denial. He's been a friend forever. His daughter's younger than I, and so on. And I'm probably his best friend. I hope I'm a good listener, but he's on the morphine now, and he's into the pain. Is just,
yeah.
You know, you talk about going out and flying Disney, and I'm thinking, this would be wonderful, but in the six, he's had the bladder and the kidney, and he's been British in 6-8 years. But now in January it started, and I just see him back. I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if I will see him in his home in the next 3 weeks when I return.
Yeah.
You just be a good listener?
I think you just be a wonderful listener. There's a great book, and they have it in the bookstore. It's called...
Final Gifts?
No, Final Gifts is very good. I gave that to Helen, my friend Helen, when she knew that she would be dying. No, this is called Before You Sleep or Before I Sleep or Before Sleep. It's by Elizabeth Berg, and it's wonderful. And it talks about three friends, and one of them is dying of cancer. I think the only thing I can say is be as open and honest with him as you need to be for yourself. And
but you see, I'll come right out. I'm a very open person. And I don't want to just say, well, I know you're going to die.
But I think it's okay to say, you know, we don't know where this journey's going to go, okay. Sam, and I'm going to miss you, you know, and I want to talk to you about my feelings for you, and I want to tell you what a good friend you are, and, you know, you may make it through this right now, you may not, and if you don't,
right.
I want to be with you, and I want to talk to you. And I think it's important for you to deal with your own feelings with him and share them. If he's in denial... And sometimes they may look like they're in denial, but they're not. They're in denial because they think you don't want to talk about it. And so you put up a good front, and everybody's putting up a good front. But I think it's very okay to say, I'm really sorry this is happening, and I'm going to miss you a whole lot. I don't know when you're going to go, but sooner or later we're all going to go, and I'm going to miss you. And if he says, well, I don't want to talk about it, say, that's okay. I just want to talk to you about my feelings. Mm-hmm. And this is what I'm feeling. And to me, that's what's most important. And I think that I've heard people say, well, calling out a friend of cancer, I didn't know what to say. And I said, just say what you want to say. Say what feels right. And sometimes Helen or Alan Hill was another man who was, he had leukemia. He had been in remission for 5 years when I met him. His leukemia had come back. And we'd talk about it, and I'd say, how you doing, Alan? Fine. And he'd say, oh, I'm doing just great. And he went on a 5-mile hike the week before he died. And I said, you want to talk about it? Sometimes he would, sometimes he wouldn't. And I think it's just say, do you want to talk about it? Do you want to talk about your funeral? What do you want it to be? And I know each one of my friends that has died have planned their own funeral, just like I've planned mine. Now, what I did a month ago, I liked my funeral so much. I said, I don't want to miss it. So I had a party, and then we called it a celebration of life. And my parents were there. They're 81 years old. And I did it in honor of them, in honor of my daughter graduating from high school, and in honor of myself. And we cried, and we laughed, and we told stories, and I read some things I had written, and they did, and we showed slides, and I had music going, and I said, this is great. So now I'm ready to go, because I know what it's going to be like. But it was a wonderful tribute, and people don't do that. And my father said, well, now I know what my eulogy is going to be, and I said, yeah. I said, we wait until people die to say all these great things. So I'd say it now. I'm wondering if you have more questions or if Dana, my daughter's in the back there against the wall, if she wants to say a couple of words or if you have any questions you want to ask of her.
Could I ask one question?
Yeah.
Are you accepted now, Dana?
You're doing these lectures.
Are you accepted or accepted?
Don't you feel this is a form of therapy for you too?
Yeah.
To be able to.
Well, the therapy for me is, I think, the book was the therapy for me to express myself. The reason I like to, I did one last week in this is the only one I've done. And I thought, well, I'll just see how it goes. But to me, what's important is, I think it's important to get the message out that it's okay to be open, it's okay to be honest, it's okay to talk about death and dying, it's okay to be, you know, to share your feelings. And I think that's kind of the message I would like to get out, is deal with it openly with people.
Okay, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wondered if you were coping with this whole situation better now. You feel like you were kind of in control a little bit?
Yeah, actually I do. And it started, going kind of back a ways. Our family has been, it's really scattered. We're all extremely independent. And, you know, mom would work somewhat, you know, 80 hours a week. My dad works the same. So, you know, our family, we would never see each other. And then this hit, and all of a sudden, we're all together. And, you know, as she said, you know, we fought and everything. And I think in dealing with it, it really helped me deal with it. Because, you know, it's not something you can deal with by yourself.
No.
You just can't do that. And you think, oh, I'm fine. But really, you're not. And you know, what really helped me deal with it was mom being extremely open about how, you know, what was going on with her, how she was feeling, you know, and having like family nights where we'd sit down and, you know, just sit and talk about what was going on, what we were feeling, you know. Even if it wasn't about the cancer, we'd just sit down and talk about, you know, anything. And that, you know, that really helped kind of keep things in touch and keep things going, and you really felt comfortable. And I think another thing that, and what helped me, I think, a lot is when mom's treatments would come around, my brother and my dad would disappear. And it was amazing how dad all of a sudden had to work, you know, extra hours, and how Keaton was all of a sudden extra busy, you know. And so I all of a sudden became mom, and, you know, I would cook dinners and get everything going, clean the house, take care of all the animals. And then I, you know, a lot of times I just sit in the bedroom and talk to mom. Some days we just sit there, never say a word. But it was that time of, you know, you're both, even though you're not saying anything, you're both thinking your own things and you're in the presence of each other. And, you know, often and after school, when my grandparents were out there and I couldn't drive yet, you know, they'd pick me up after school, and when she'd be in the hospital, we'd go over to the hospital and just sit in the hospital room. You know, and I think that really helped me deal with it, because I sat and I saw it face to face, I watched it, I listened, and, you know, when she would have something to say, my brother would have something to say, my dad, I'd just sit and listen. And I, you know, it's hard sometimes for me to sit and express exactly what I'm feeling. So, you know, I tend to go around the tree to get it. And you had to face it. And I think, you know, that helped, just talking about it and being open. So that's kind of how I dealt with it.
Yeah. And after we went to Disneyland, the kids said, that is a pretty good thing.
Yeah.
Have you been on any other trips?
Yeah.
Many.
I then started, my doctors didn't let me travel for a long time. And then I started traveling again, but very, very differently in my job. It changed dramatically. I used to do 3 countries in 1 week. I then started doing 2 countries a week or 2 countries in 2 weeks. And I started taking my kids with me. Every trip I took, they went with me. Dana's been to Japan, China, and Korea. My son's been to Australia, New Zealand, Greece. Taiwan, Greece, Italy. So they started traveling with me so we could spend that time together. And that was good. Then I left my job in February and started my own business because the company that I was with was sold last May. And the new owner and I just couldn't work with him. And one of the things I said after having cancer is I will not spend any time doing something that's out of alignment with my truth and my soul. It's life's too short. I'm not going to waste it. So I just up and quit. And people, you know, even then I called my husband, so I just quit my job. He said, what? I quit my job. And I had a 6-figure income. I was president of the company when I quit in February. And I just walked away from it and said, it's not worth it. And everyone said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. I'll do something. But then I started my own business, and I love it. I'm having a great time. So, and one day I had a meeting, and my son called from school 2 minutes before it was to start. People had come from out of town. It was 11 o'clock, and normally I would have said, I'm sorry, Pete, and he said, I don't feel well. I would have said in the past, I'm sorry, just tough it out. But I just said, no, my priorities are my family first. So I went out and I told the people who were already there, the receptionist said they're here, and I said, well, here's the deal. My son is at school and he's sick. I have to take him home. You have a choice. You can come back at 1:30 or you can go with me and we can have our meeting in the car. And they said, we'll go with you. I said, okay. And we all piled in my car and off we went. And we had our business meeting in the car, talked the whole way, picked up my son, took him home. I said, you're going to have to wait while I get him settled. Got him settled, got him some soup, got in the car, and we went back to the office. I never would have done that before. Never. But I just said that's...
What is the name of your book?
The Buttercup Has My Smile.
Is that available yet?
No, it's in process. It's in the hands of an agent right now. So it'll be at least a year before it's out.
At least a what?
Probably at least a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it takes a long time. So we'll see. Yeah. But look for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going to say something about two things, kind of, actually. She's saying priorities. And, you know, when something like this comes up, and with friends, family, anybody, you really kind of see your priorities. And you'll, you know, and notice with others. And I see even with, like, my friends and stuff. I just graduated high school, I'm not that old, and so, you know, your priorities are more into your friends and, you know, other places than, you know, kind of down to earth where they could be. And this really opens your eyes up to where your priorities should be and what could be happening in life. And I think not our whole family's priorities really took a twist and turn, you know, and it no longer, like for mom and dad, it was no longer, well, I have to work, you know, sorry, go get, you know, have your friends give you a ride and stuff. It was like, okay, you know, I'm coming home. It's time to have dinner with the family. And, you know, priorities became more friends, family, and stuff, and not so much the work and office. And also, you know, with this priorities, it, you know, it really brought us together. And I think now I'm much closer with my mom, definitely, than I ever have been.
Let me just say one thing. We're willing to stay and answer questions. The bell did ring if anybody wants to go to First Supper, but you're welcome to stay. We're not trying to get out of here, so yeah. It's up to you.
Yeah. I'll stay a little bit with you. I've often asked, I have friends who have had cancer, who have seen some of my friends die through cancer. But one of the things that is different is that very often I have not seen their families or heard their families talk about it. And I think my question is mostly, for example, now at your age with your friends, do you talk about, are you able to talk about this and with friends of your own age?
Yeah, actually I am. I wasn't at first, and that was really hard. Yeah. That was really hard because, you know, it's hard. This happened, I was in eighth grade,
And, you know, in eighth grade, it's hard to talk to your friends about a serious subject like cancer. Because people just, yeah, you know, okay, I understand, whatever. But people don't understand, you know, and... Yeah, or what?
I think you were a sophomore in high school. Oh, well, it doesn't matter.
2 years ago.
Doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Anyway, it was like freshman year, right? I was not old. But, you know, when you go to talk to your friends about it, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I really, you know, I mean, talk to me. I'll listen. I'm happy. And, you know, when it's time to talk, then you start talking to your friends. Oh, guess what happened today? I don't care. You know? And... It would be stuff like that, you know, you would never get to talk. And I did actually, and you know, mom said there were your close friends and the distant friends, and the same happened, you know, I never had it, but with me, and you know, talking about it. And my bestest friend, actually we weren't even really that good friends then. I mean, we're still best friends, but it was like we kind of had space, and some people that I wasn't really friends with, and who listened to what I was saying, you know, and just let me talk, we've now become extremely good friends. And there were a lot of people, you know, that I could sit down and just talk with about it and about what's going on. And, you know, they'd understand and they'd listen. And, you know, you could see that they cared. And, you know, it was hard to talk to people who, you know, you would sit, I want to talk to you about this, I really want to listen and everything. Okay, you know, and, you know, we'd start to talk about it, and all of a sudden, you know, they're looking around, and they're like, are you listening? Yeah, I'm listening, you know. Yeah, keep talking, I fully understand. And the next thing you know, they're all of a sudden talking about something else that happened in the day, and you're like, no. And so it was hard to talk to my friends about it, except for a few.
And I'm sure you had, you know, many, many prayers that have been said for you. And then I talked to Lynn yesterday at some length, and last night after I had read the Bible and some Bible verses, and she was on my mind, and I said, Lord, help me to pray for Lynn. Send the Spirit to help me pray. And I found myself on my knees praying for you last night, Lynn. And it just helped me so much to know that you're going to be healed, you know, because that's the way my prayer came out. She is going to live to see her children grow up.
Yeah, I had many people praying for me, and my sisters and family in their churches were saying prayers, and
they very powerful. I'm a believer in prayer.
Yeah, very powerful.
I had a son who was given up for dead, mm-hmm. and we had so many people praying for him that he's still living today.
But God doesn't always answer it that way.
No, he doesn't.
Not always the way we, you know, want him to, mm-hmm. but sometimes it.
Oh, nice, right.
He says, hey, they want that girl to live. I'm going to make her live.
Well, that's what I learned. I learned to stop praying for life.
Yeah.
I learned to stop praying, make me live, and I learned to start saying, help me to enjoy every day that I'm alive. Help me to teach my children how to enjoy life.
How and is your sister doing?
She's doing very well. She's doing very well. And I think one of the things that she helped me with in coping with the death process is that she was in a cancer support group. Mm-hmm. And there was a woman who came to this group every single week, not because she had cancer. She was the wife of one of the men in the group who had cancer. And no one paid any attention to her. She came and she would sit and do her knitting and read a book, and she was just there to support her husband. Mm-hmm. And one Wednesday she wasn't there. And they said, where is she? What had happened? She was the first one in the group to die.
She was the what?
First one to die. She had an allergic reaction to some medication, and she died almost instantly. And it was a shock. The whole group went into shock because they said, my God, we have been sitting here talking about ourselves, ignoring her, and she's the first one to go. So that was a real wake-up call that you never know. None of us know. And maybe the gift of cancer is you get some forewarning. You get to talk about it. She didn't get to put closure on anything. And so I think you're exactly right. The outcome, I learned to say the prayers were not like in the beginning, you better make me live through this thing no matter what, down to thank you God for helping me to learn to live
every
day.
Now, how young is the
girl? Yeah, Nikki.
When did you have your, did you have breast cancer?
Yours is?
Yeah, I was 26.
So how long ago?
2 years. So about 2 years in May I had surgery. I started chemo in June, 2 years ago.
And how you're doing?
So far, just keep going back every 3 months. They don't say anything positive to you.
No.
They just keep saying, come back in 3 months.
You keep hoping they'll say something positive, yeah. And they don't. They just say, and you know, how about headaches, coughing, bones, you know, pain here.
Did they do a new test on you?
They do test on me every 3 months. They, I have blood tests, and there's like a blood panel, and then we have chest x-ray, mammogram. I have that about every 6 months.
Was your discovery also just by routine checkup? Or?
I found the lump myself, and I told my doctor about it, and I went to, he sent me to a surgeon then, and then at first they said it was just fibrous tissue, and I went back for 2 more checkups after the first time seeing the surgeon, and the third time she said, this feels differently, and did a needle biopsy and called me on a Friday afternoon and left me a message saying, please call me at home, and they never do that. And so I called and they said, we want you to come in for a biopsy Monday morning. And then when I got there, go through the chest x-ray and mammogram and get, you know, I'm all prepped and ready for, you know, the biopsy surgery. And they told me, we want you to make some decisions because we're 99% sure it's cancer. And so then I met with all of the other doctors before I had that surgery, and then I went and got a second opinion, and they just took one look at my chest x-ray and said, yeah, you have cancer. So I was the one who discovered my cancer.
Awful lot of women discover it themselves.
Yeah.
I tell you, when I had my biopsy, and the doctor found it wasn't really a lump, but it was suspicious, and he said, I'd like to have a biopsy. That was in 1970, when they gave you this kind of thing. You went in, yeah. Had surgery, had your biopsy, and the doctor told you before he put you to sleep, we will send it up to the laboratory if it comes back cancer.
They don't do that anymore.
No, I know they don't, but that's a horrible thing. And when I woke up, you know, that's the first thing I did. You know?
Yeah. At least I knew. Awesome. And what I did, I put them off for 3 weeks because I said 3 weeks isn't going to make any difference at all. And I looked at my doctor the day, you know, I just met him. The thing about cancer is you're thrown into a circle of people you don't know, complete strangers. You go to your doctor all your life, you think, oh, I have a lot of confidence in him. And the first thing he says is, go see this doctor, and then that doctor says, go see this doctor, and suddenly you're moving further and further away from your known circle. And so when my gynecologist was the one I went to, because he always did my exams, and he immediately sent me to this surgeon, who I had just said, how do you do? You know, my name's Lynn. And 10 minutes later, he looks and he says, you've got cancer. He starts, da, 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 this is what we're gonna do. And I said, so he said, do you have any questions? And I said, well, I have one. And he said, what's that? And I said, why are you qualified to treat me? I said, who are you? I don't know who you are. I don't know anything about you. For all I know, you...